Broadcasting from the Mono Wind Casino Studios. This is Multicultural AM 1600 KGST Fresno.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Dermogradichian. Today, my guest is Eric Hagopian. He is a veteran of American politics. He's a political consultant who lived in the United States, but has moved to Armenia. And welcome to the show today, Eric.
It's a pleasure.
So the reason I've asked Eric to be here and to talk about things is because for the last 3 years, he's been living in Armenia, and he's been closely following the events of the Artsakh-Azerbaijan conflict, and of course, just being able to comment on what's been happening in Armenia. So let's start with recent events. The war that started on September 27th and ended on November 9th with the signing of an agreement taking effect November 10th. Tell us a little bit about that. The actual agreement as to in your opinion what that agreement was all about.
Well, first of all, there's no agreement. It's a ceasefire agreement, and we've got to be very careful with that. That whatever was signed was to end the war. It is not some kind of it's not the text for peace. It's just something to end the war. There's a distinction there. Obviously, the results were disastrous by any measure. And the what was signed was essentially a capitulation. It was not something that, you know, both sides give. It was, we give and they take. Because they essentially, because of countless different reasons, won the war. So they get to dictate the terms. And the terms were pretty atrocious in almost every way. So that obviously has triggered a political crisis, as is expected in any kind of a situation like that. And these are the times that we're living in. I mean, we can talk about more details about that period, but I'll leave that to you about where you want to go with that.
Well, you were in Armenia when the war broke out. And one of the things that I was following also from Fresno, from such a distance, was the news about the war and the progress of the war. And I mean, from our perspective, it seemed like at least we know that the Armenians were holding their own and even maybe pushing them back. And then suddenly this almost overnight end to the war. So how do you explain that? Was it misinformation? What was it?
I think that it was very clear that it's two things, because there's elements of truth there. Because as you know, a war, first of all, this was the most serious conflict on the European continent since World War II. Let's just be clear about that. This was a military front that stretched almost 250 kilometers, okay? Of 250 kilometers of intense fighting. This has nothing to do with the wars of the 90s, which, you know, in reality were sort of shotgun wars. Or even the Balkan wars between Yugoslavia. And I mean, this is the intensity of this war was literally World War II scale, except with drones. So it was tremendous fighting, tremendous firepower. Now, in most of the fronts, we were actually holding our own, especially wherever those fronts were mountainous. So in most places, we actually held, and what you're describing was actually true. The one place that we didn't hold, and it was a function of geography, was in the south. This is right by the Iranian border where it's flat. And once they made that breakthrough, they were able to sort of crawl up the underbelly of Artsakh itself and eventually, over 44 days, fight their way into Shushi. And at that point, if they would have continued, if the war would have continued, essentially all of the other lines would have collapsed because they would have been essentially behind our lines. So from a military perspective, it was checkmate, even though, you know, we held our own in, you know, four out of the five other fronts. But that's not how wars work. It's just, they're the won or lost in totality. They're not won or lost on, you know, you win this battle or that battle. So wherever it was that the terrain was favorable, we held. And our guys fought like hell, to be honest, especially our young guys and conscripts. I think part of the shock that came to people, and it came to us, and it came to me, obviously, is there was a fair amount of lying going on during the entirety of the war, because they were not telling us about the how badly the war was going, especially in the South. So when people think that, okay, you know, we're falling behind, but we're holding our own against tremendous odds, and suddenly you essentially have this capitulation, it's going to create this tremendous anger. Now, frankly, who was lying to who? We're not even sure. For all we know, the political leadership could have been lied to by the military. People in the military could have been lying to each other. So, or all of them could be lying to us, you know, collectively. So it's really hard to know what was really, you know, who's at fault, quote unquote, in misinforming us. I would say that they're all collectively at fault in misinforming us, because at the end of the day, none of that matters. If you're political leadership, you should know what's going on. And I think if they would have told people a lot earlier what the situation was, if it was dire, then it would have been a lot better. People would have handled these things a lot better. I think part of the issue here is that there were different periods in the war where different things were happening. You know, for example, for the first week or 10 days, there was nothing happening, not even the Southern Front. So if this war would have ended like the last one, the 2016 one, it would have been a victory, you know, given what we were up against and the scale of the firepower and the scale of the number of, you know, multitudes of countries that were fighting against us. But that's not what happened. So I think the fact that they were not, the shock is a result of them not being truthful with us.
And the scale of the war, you said it's the, in your opinion, the most intense warfare since World War II.
That's not even a question.
And the reality is that was partially because, or, and I'd like to hear your opinion, but the involvement of Turkey, how much were they involved? Maybe more than even people here realize the extent of their involvement, and then the extent of the efficiency, let's say, of the drones. In other words, the role that the drones played in the overall warfare.
First of all, the Turkish involvement was unprecedented, and it essentially involved three things. It involved they took over the command, essentially. What happened in Tavush in July, after the Azeri military was humiliated in the small-scale fighting that happened there, Aliyev essentially turned over his military command to the Turks. I mean, this is not even conjecture. You hear about it in Russian and Azeri, and mostly in Russian press, because in Azerbaijan, they don't even have any kind of a free press, of Azeri generals complaining about it. One of them, in fact, went on record saying, all that's left for us to give to the Turks is our wives, which, as you know, in this part of the world, that's quite a statement to make. So they essentially, the Turks ran the entire military command in its entirety. The war was run by essentially NATO command, that's sort of, to put it in simpler terms, or NATO quality command. Second thing is they had thousands of special forces there. In fact, in their victory parade today, they weren't hiding the fact that their special forces were there because they were part of the parade. If they weren't part of the parade, then what were they doing there? And third, obviously, was the drone program, which our side was entirely and just irresponsibly not ready for, given the fact that this technology is not new. Those three factors, the Turkish factor was the reason, the primary reason for our defeat, and it was the primary reason that this war did not, that all of those ceasefires failed. So this war was driven by the Turks. It would have never, this victory would not have happened without them. And it's due to them that this victory happened. Yes, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it seems to me then that their influence then has risen compared to that military involvement in this region, which seems to me it's a clear danger for Russian influence or Russian interests. So how do you assess?
It is a danger, and it was a danger, except what happened, if you read the ceasefire agreement, Erdogan is quite upset right now, no matter what he says or does, he's quite upset at Aliyev, because if you read the ceasefire agreement, he threw Erdogan entirely under the bus. The Turks did all the fighting, they did all the organizing, and they got nothing out of it. If you read, I mean, all this, you know, hyperbole that you hear from them, we're going to be the part of the peacekeepers, it's all nonsense. All they got out of it was some office, you know, half an hour outside of Artsakh, where they're going to sit there, supposedly monitor the Russian peacekeepers and drink tea together, while the Russians in this last month have violated every single part of the agreement that they signed. They have far greater number of troops than was assigned there, far greater. And they have all kinds of weaponry there they have no business doing, and no one has dared to say anything about it. So essentially, in the last minute, Aliyev threw Erdogan under the bus for complex different reasons, part of him having to do with his own political survival, but we'll get to that later. So they did all the work, but the influence that they got out of it so far has been quite limited.
So I want to talk a little bit about Artsakh itself. Now, are you in contact with people there? Do you talk to people there, or are you reading?
I'm in contact with people who come and go. It's not like I get on the phone with Artsakhis himself, but being in the CivilNet office, there's reporters that come and go, and there's foreign reporters that come and go. So I haven't been there myself, but I've been in contact with people who come and go from there. So yes, that's the case.
And the reason I'm asking is because to me it's always been a paradox or a question as to how you talked about the unpreparedness or the inability of perhaps of the Armenians in Artsakh or in Armenia to foresee what would possibly happen. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that? It must have been very clear that they were acquiring weapons of a great amount of weapons. They mm-hmm. they talked about it. I remember Aliyev saying that we will spend more on military than the entire budget of Armenia. Mm-hmm. And then it's not a secret that Israel was selling drones to Azerbaijan. So were they just fighting the wrong war? Were they just fighting the last war?
I think there's definitely a level of arrogance because of how poorly the Azeri troops had essentially performed in the last war and even in the 2016 war and in the Tavush war. You know, it was a complete fail. I mean, they have all these weapons, except they had third-rate leadership, you know? You had second-rate troops, first-rate armaments, and third-rate leadership, okay? We could always beat them, okay? What we couldn't beat is first-rate, you know, second-rate soldiers, first-rate armaments, and first-rate leadership. That was the qualitative change. So they were obviously overconfident in the sense that they expected to be meeting the same dunderhead generals that they had beaten before, and that was not the case. The second thing that we have found out is this, you know, we always assumed that this sort of the state dysfunction that we've had in Armenia since independence was somehow the army was exempt from it. Well, we found out that the army is not exempt from it. It was a dysfunctional institution in the sense that they were not prepared. No one was thinking about these things. There were tremendous logistical issues. We don't know all the details about the failures, to be honest, because you need a deep inquiry, and I'm not a military expert. And since so many people talk with such certainty, I will not, because unless you know, you shouldn't say it. But it's very clear that there were tremendous weaknesses. Structurally, poor management, poor leadership. And the one thing that is consistent across the board from everybody you speak to, people, reporters who were there, to foreign military attaches, to our reporters, to our, you know, the best part of our army were the 18, 19-year-old conscripts that turned this military plan that should have ended in 3 days, they turned to 44 days. So to put things in context, I was told by one of these experts that with the advantages that the Azeri and Turkish and these terrorist forces had, they should have been in Rome in 44 days, not in Shushi in 44 days. So no matter what happens, we should not forget the absurd, you know, heroism of some of these kids who did incredible things. And we should all be eternally grateful to them. So I think that's the sort of the brief of it as far as what you were asking about.
So actually then it's that Artsakh is kind of reflects Armenia in the sense of its political structure and also military, and in the sense that, I mean, they must be in communication with each other very closely. So the failures are also Armenia's failure.
It is. First of all, communication was another area of just tremendous, you know. Listen, we had a complete system failure. We have to be honest about this. We had a complete system failure, and this just shows in the military side. But our governmental structures were a failure. Our foreign policy was a failure. Our diplomatic corps was a failure. Our diaspora institutions were a failure to a great extent until the war started. So I think we need to be honest about these things, and not be, you know, we can't be Pollyannish and, you know, or blame other people. We have to take responsibility for these failures. You know, we spent 30 years, we wasted 25 years by not building a functional government, a functional economy, and all of that leads to a not functional military. So no one should be shocked by, we should be shocked at how relatively well we did given these dysfunctions. So I think people look at it the wrong way.
Yeah, and then people look at, we look at lost opportunity, which is easy to look at in hindsight. And the lost opportunities were during multiple Armenian administrations, there have been, diplomatic attempts to solve the issue permanently, and it wasn't done. Why wasn't it done earlier? Why wasn't it done by Kocharyan, who must have known the situation as much as anybody, or Serge Sarkisian?
Well, I think this is where we got to be careful, because the reason that they were not done is not because of our side. And as you can probably guess, I'm not a big fan of the previous regimes that ran this country, but the reason that there's not a permanent peace here is the other side. The other side always said no. In 2001 in Key West, Kocharyan was going to trade all of the occupied territories plus a road through Sunik, the Mevri Road that connects Azerbaijan with Nakhchivan, for an independent Artsakh. Okay, the older Aliyev, the father, accepted it. He goes back to Baku and changes his mind. 10 years later in Kazan, Serge Sarkisian essentially approves pretty much the same thing, minus the road, except this is not even independence. It's some mid-level of recognition. Okay? He said yes. The other side said no. So this is not both sides fail. We wanted peace. What they want is Artsakh without Armenia. That's the dichotomy. That's why we don't have peace. Otherwise, they could have had these occupied territories 20 years ago, and people could have been living in them, and we could have had functional relations. And 2001 deal was very good for us, and frankly, it was good for them, because you wouldn't have had all of these people living in limbo all of these years. So there's no two sides to this. There's our side that wanted peace, and theirs that wants Artsakh sees out of Artsakh and a ethnically cleansed Artsakh.
It's never been, in my opinion, it's never been just strictly a one-on-one or even Artsakh, Armenia, Azerbaijan. This is a conflict which is in a broader geopolitical situation that Russia has something to say, Turkey has something to say, presumably the United States, which was very absent in the recent events, has mm-hmm. to say. So where did they stand? Why could they not have added that little bit of inducement or pressure or whatever word you want to use to really solve it? Or it must have not been in their interest to do so.
Well, I think it wasn't in the Russian interest to do so, because I think these kinds of conflicts are useful to them. But were they sitting there behind the scenes telling people not to sign? I don't think so. I think for the Western countries, it's just not that important. It'll be one less thing for them to deal with, but they would have been fine with the status quo prior to the 27th of September for the next 20 years, as they're fine with the Turkish occupation of Cyprus. Okay. And they're fine with this now, if this is what's going to hold for the next 20 years. They just don't want fighting. Okay. So they're not, it's not a question of who gets what. I think with the Russians, they obviously, these kinds of conflicts are helpful to them. And they, they're the biggest winners of this war. Do not doubt that. The Azeris are the second biggest winner, but the biggest winners are the Russians, because They've gotten what they really wanted, which is to come back in a big way. And Artsakh is becoming this significant sized Russian military base. And now they have their foot on the jugular of Azerbaijan. They were quite proud of the fact that there were no Russian boots on the ground. They got their jugular, obviously, all over Artsakh, and they got their foot on the jugular of Armenia. They're the biggest winners of this war. And frankly, some of the smarter Azeris understand that, because they know that, you know, these guys, once these guys come in, this five-year thing is fantasy. They're never going to leave. Even if you ask them to leave, they're not going to leave. You know, they'll come up with an excuse not to leave. And the amount of troops and stuff that they're going in, building and doing that, they're not leaving. So they're the biggest winners of this war. Now, were they preventing an agreement? I have no reason to. I don't know enough to say that. But does it fit their interests, this current situation? Oh, absolutely, it fits their interests.
My guest today is Eric Hakopian. He's living today in Armenia. He's a political consultant that has been commenting frequently with CivilNet and other organizations talking about affairs in Armenia, Artsakh, the recent war. We're going to take a brief break on All Things Armenian and come back in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm Professor Barlo Demirgardichian. My guest today is Eric Hakopian. We've been discussing, Eric, the situation following the end of the war, the ceasefire in Artsakh and in Armenia. You were talking about the idea that Russia is the biggest political winner in this conflict, because now they have their boots literally on the ground. But it seems to me that is also favorable for the Armenians in Artsakh, because it does provide security.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, we need to be quite practical about this. Today, as things stand right now, there's nobody here that complains about the Russian presence in Artsakh. There's nobody that sees it as anything but a positive. And this is across the board in this society. And obviously Artsakhis, who frankly are probably the most pro-Russian people in the former Soviet Union, have no problem with this whatsoever. So we need to be honest about this. You know, up until September 27th, we were capable of providing security for the Artsakhis. The war proved that we couldn't do that, at least now. And the Russian presence there, in however horrible terms in these ceasefire, essentially allows people to go back and, live in security. Because one thing about the Russians is if you look at their experience in different places in the Caucasus, where it's Abkhazia or other places, Ossetia, where they have troops, the one thing that they do is to provide security. If for no other reason than the fact that since they're a gigantic, they're a world power, and all the local countries are minnows. So no one's going to ever shoot at Russian peacekeepers or ask them to leave. You know, Saakashvili in Georgia made the mistake of shooting over Russian peacekeepers, not even at them. And in 3 days, they were in Tbilisi. And trust me, people know that lesson. I sort of laughed when, I think it was O'Brien, the National Security Advisor, was saying you shouldn't have Russians and you should have the Swedes and the Finns or whatever. No. Because if you shoot at them, they won't shoot back. They'll come talk to you. If you shoot at the Russians, they'll shoot back at you 10 times, 10 times over. So in the short run, the Russian presence is seen as a positive because it sort of rescues a really horrendous situation.
There's been a lot of course, now in Armenia and in the diaspora, there are many theories, conspiracies, all of these kinds of things that are discussed. But one thing that seems to me talked about was that perhaps Prime Minister Pashinyan could have taken an earlier agreement, perhaps early in October. Mm-hmm. You mentioned there were several of these attempted agreements and some failed, but that he could have taken one earlier. It's a hindsight, of course, but which would have left more territory to Artsakh with a better ending. How do you see that? Or is that?
Well, first of all, you're an academic, as you know, an event like this notion that a month afterward, you're going to know all the basics is right. Rather fanciful. So I would say this, it's theoretically possible that that's true. It's also quite theoretically possible that it isn't true. And I'll tell you why I think it's probably not true. The primary driver of this war and the person that broke these three ceasefires was not Pashinyan, was not Putin, and it was not Aliyev. It was Erdogan. Okay? So Pashinyan could have 20 conversations with Aliyev. He could have had 20 conversations with... they could have all of these three individuals could have agreed to something. But given the fact that the car keys were in Erdogan's hands, he could have done what he did with the other ceasefires, which is what they did. I mean, let's not forget, on the 10th, Sergei Lavrov, who's one of the great diplomats of the world, for 7 hours hammered out this agreement, during which Putin actually called in to these things. So, and the next morning they violated, essentially humiliating him. Okay? So this notion that they could have just talked and settled it, they were not the only, if this was 2016, this war would have ended on the 10th, probably even earlier. It's the Turkish factor that kept this war going. So he could have had this deal that would have been somewhat more favorable, but it could have been also irrelevant because they were not the shot callers. They're not the only shot. I mean, they were not the shot callers during the war, at least during that period of the call. So this is something that we will know many years later. So, but anybody that definitively says he had this and he said no, we don't know that. And plus, from what I understand, that included allowing, 20,000 Azeris to move back to Shushi. That was always part of that. That was the non-negotiator. Well, what is the difference between losing Shushi and having 20,000 people there, given the size of the city? So I think it's easy to say this. My general view is you can blame Pashinyan's fault in the war for the things that happened prior to the war, of not seeing this coming. Not keeping the negotiations going in their old format. He's a lot more to blame about things that happened before the war. I think realistically, he's far less to blame for things that happened during the war. By the way, the other thing is, which we would always get is, during the war, people would go, Pashinyan, he's a journalist, and it's a good thing he's leaving the war to the generals, because they're the experts. Well, then which one is it? Is he responsible for everything or is he not responsible for everything? You can't say he was not micromanaging, letting the professionals do it until you found out that the professionals didn't know what they were doing and now he's micromanaging. So you can't have this multitude of stories. It's got to be one or the other. So I to answer that question, we're not going to know the truth of that for a long time. And it could be that, you know, he gave up an opportunity to finish it earlier. But it could have been that it could also be the case that whatever was talked between the two of them or the three of them would have been irrelevant. Because at that point, the shot caller was not part of that conversation.
Well, some people also talk about Pashinyan, though, in the sense that one of his faults was that he began to position Armenia as trying to get closer again to the West, this sort of constant idea of Armenia moving away out of the Russian influence slightly, or trying to, and that in a way that this war was a result that Putin kept his hands off. Now, what do you think about that? I mean, is that, again, I know you're talking about Turkey is the big player.
Sure. People say that, but what proof do they have that Armenia was moving away from its previous foreign policy positions? Did Armenia try to join the EU? No. Did Armenia try to get out of this economic union with the former Soviet states that's important for the Russians? No. Did Armenia try to join NATO? No. So I think there are stylistic things, to the sense that given the fact that Pashinyan came through a revolution, which the Russians hate. They hate things like that because obviously they're an authoritarian state in many ways. It's not like back in the old Soviet days, but you know, it's not a democracy in the sense that me and you recognize it as a democracy. And Pashinyan is, you know, the only leader in this region that actually was elected democratically, you know, except for Georgia. I mean, the greater Soviet region, that's quite an exception to the rule. So I think this whole notion that he was moving away from, I mean, people say that, but what's the proof? I think there were things that were done with him, with their personal relationship, which were foolish, that I've heard from multitudes of people. But at the end of the day, great powers do not make political decisions based on, I like this person, I don't like this person. It's this far greater self-interest. And let's not forget, you know, this, whatever relationship they have, if the ceasefire and the 10th would have held, we would have had much, much better results than we have now. Hell, some people would have thought it's a victory. And he put his name and his top diplomat on it. So whatever issues they might have had, or maybe they still have, it didn't stop the Russians from trying to stop the war. And if it wasn't for the factor of the Turkish influence, which was new, unlike 2016, it probably would have worked. So it's easy to say that, but those people who say that don't provide proof for their assertions. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that you were mentioning earlier about the systemic failures in Armenia, both diplomatic, military, etc. Let's talk a little bit about that. What was perhaps in your mind one of the top failures in this whole situation?
Okay, the war starts. We're surrounded by, everyone is against us. You know, every single state around us is, the only ones that were neutral or not against us were Russia and Iran. Okay, and they weren't openly against us. Because, you know, their interests somewhat aligned with ours. So there's that. But let me give you a perfect example. A month before this Artsakh war started, the UAE, which they call Little Sparta, you know, they got this a small country but has a tremendous military capacity. They bombed Turkish air bases in Libya a month before this war started, and they killed a lot of Turkish pilots and soldiers. You think our diplomats ever flew to the UAE during the 44 days of the war? No. Did they fly to Saudi Arabia that funds a lot of the anti-Turkish stuff all of the region? No. And if I know that and they don't know that, then that's a problem. You know, right. I'm not exactly a diplomat. There's this lack of just sort of imaginative thinking about how you approach these things. Or a lack of thinking in general. So that's on that front. Let's look at the military front. You know, since Barack Obama was elected president in 2008, one of the things he did was he wanted to substitute U.S. troops and not have U.S. troops get killed. So they moved to this essentially drone warfare. You know, they used to have assassination Tuesdays or something where they used to meet and decide who they're going to assassinate. That started in 2009. Okay. It's been 11 years. You would think that all of those generals, you know, there's this beautiful defense ministry building on top of the hill in Yerevan. Modern, looks like the Pentagon. You'd think that someone would have thought that one day this might visit us, given the fact that in 2016, it did visit us. Did anyone think about this? Did anyone act on it? In Libya, a couple of months before this, you know, the Turkish drones essentially destroyed all the Russian anti-missile systems. You know, they thought the Russians got a good hiding out of it. So if you don't see this coming, what were you doing all these years? You had to see it coming. So this is just irresponsibility. It's essentially systematic failure. And it can only be dealt with systematically. You got to tear things up and rebuild it. So, and you know, whatever you say about Pashinyan, when this started, when the drone started being ineffective, he was in jail. What were these generals doing? And the other thing, which is quite upsetting about all of this, is that no one takes responsibility for any of this. You know, every day there's another press conference by some general blaming this person, that person. Okay, fine, you know. I'm sure other political leaders made 1,000 mistakes. They should have taken a peace deal earlier. We don't know. I mean, okay, let's assume you're correct. But tell me, you take responsibility first for your failures, then I'll listen to you. Otherwise, it's just finger pointing.
Well, let's see. Let's talk about the effect then of this on Armenia's politics. Just yesterday, I believe, in Armenia, there was opposition groups calling for Prime Minister Pashinyan's resignation. Obviously, it hasn't taken place. You're talking about systemic change. I don't see any opposition that has any authoritative position in Armenia. I mean, it's either going to be going back to the old oligarchs and the old system, or you have Pashinyan, who represented perhaps the chance for change. Where does it go? Does he resign? Can he resign? And what replaces him if he does resign?
Let's talk about the opposition. By the way, during this entire period where we've suffered the most catastrophic military defeat that we've suffered since World War I, there's been no more than 5,000 people on the street in any demonstration. If you're lucky, 6,000 or 7,000. And if you know, things in Armenia happen on a much larger scale than that. When people are angry, you hit the five figures rather easily. And you hit the multiple five figures if they're really serious. So the opposition, I mean, I'll give you two statements from them that will tell you all you ever need to know. 2 weeks ago, I think two and a half Sundays ago, there was this statement put out by the HHK, which is the Republican Party of Armenia, which is the old government, you know, the party that ran the country during the Serzh Sarkisian regime. And they reassured people that we want Pashinyan to go, but we don't want to come back. Okay. Yesterday, Sagatelyan of the ARF told the press that the people at the podium with them are not very popular. That's the reason people haven't come out. Well, what kind of an opposition is that? Where you're already admitting that you're not going to come back and that you're unpopular. So this current opposition is the best thing that's ever happened to Pashinyan, because they're the only people that are less popular than he is. Okay, because no matter what people think of the current situation, they don't think the solution is to go back to oligarchic rule. And it's very clear about that. So there are a lot more people that want Pashinyan to resign than are willing to come out to the street, because they don't want to be associated with that old regime. If these people are really serious about the prime minister going, but I think there's a compelling case to be made about why he should go, they literally need to leave the political space and allow other forces to come in and demand for this, because that other forces that have more credibility will actually, you know, can actually get somewhere. But at this point, they're the best thing that's ever happened to Pashinyan, because all he needs to do is to show them as the alternative, and people will run to him. Because if the alternative is incompetence, but honest compared to incompetent and dishonest, people will go for the first one.
So the people do know, the people do know what's happening then. I mean, they have a good sense.
They have an exceptionally good sense to be. I mean, I'm actually, having worked in American politics, you know, you're sometimes, you're impressed by their savviness because, yeah, everybody knows this is a catastrophe. Everybody knows that no matter what was Pashinyan, ultimately, you know, the buck stops with him. He's the ultimate responsible person. Now, you can go and make the case that, you know, 25 years of corruption is not his fault. Yes, it's true. But obviously, he has to take a lion's share of responsibility. Even if it's not his fault, he has to take a lion's share, because that's just the way it goes. Because if we would have won the war, he would have gotten all the credit. So you have to, you know, it goes with the territory. But, you know, it's people don't, they, nobody thinks that, you know, that the Serge regime coming back is the solution to their problem. So they, at the end of the day, most, I mean, I'll give you an anecdotal example. If you take a taxi in Yerevan, and if you go by one of these famous oligarchs' houses, and everybody knows who they are, people will point at them and say, you know what, this is where our anti-defense systems were. This is where our drones are. So people have a clear sense of that. This is not to exonerate Pashinyan. He needs to take responsibility. And if he needs to go, he needs to go. Because the country is far more important than one man. And he's obviously bears, even if not the all responsibility, but a significant amount of responsibility for this defeat.
But where is the legitimate opposition? I say legitimate. Where is that figure? I haven't seen those figures. I mean, of course, they do emerge, but
there isn't one. I mean, what I mean by that, first of all, listen, we have to be careful legitimately. Even the old regime is legitimate in the sense that everybody should have their voice. We know we don't want to block people out. You know, if they are who they are, but they have no support. So how can they change anything? You know? They have as much right to be out there as anybody else. But I think that real opposition will emerge once people have the assurance that the old regime is not going to be reinstalled. And you could very well have, you know, over the next couple of months, sort of, you know, non-political figures or sort of people from social, you know, from life that are not necessarily politicians or elected officials that come to the front, and or significant business people, whoever, that can say, you know what, we need a change, but don't worry, we're not going to go back to the systematic corruption we had prior to 2018. People need that assurance. And I think, and if any force like that emerges, Pashinyan could fall. I got to tell you something else. Like, for example, Pashinyan could have fallen a day or two after the war if it wasn't for what happened in the parliament that night. Because that attacking the parliament, beating the speaker, assaulting people, people taking selfie, I mean, that scene essentially scared everybody in the middle that would have been for the prime minister leaving, because that was, I'm not talking about everybody who was out in the street. There were obviously a lot of angry people that were legitimate and at every gripe. There's always, you know, that small element of people that did the ugliness of that night, the thuggery of that night, they essentially helped the prime minister tremendously, because if that's the alternative, who wants them?
My guest today is Eric Hagopian. He's an astute observer of what's been happening in Armenia. He's living now in Yerevan. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the discussion.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermogradichian. My discussion today is with Eric Hagopian. He's a veteran of American politics, a political consultant, now living in Yerevan. We've been talking about different aspects of the recent conflict in Artsakh. And we were talking about the Prime Minister and Pashinyan. But earlier you had talked about a very interesting topic, which I think I want to talk about, is the diaspora. Where was the diaspora in this? You mentioned that you saw some, I'll use the term failures, or some lack. What's on your mind with the diaspora?
First of all, let's be clear about it. I think when the war started, how people came through was tremendously positive. And what I mean by that is the money that was raised, and I can just tell you the cast of characters that were here trying to help, you know, people here going to the front. So let's be very clear about that. I'm not talking about individuals. I'm not talking about what was done during the war. I think everybody, it was commendable, and then people deserve a lot of credit for that. So we need to be very clear about that. What I mean is the long-term structural approach to the country. And let me be clear about that. For example, I think a lot of our institutions have yet to adjust to the fact that they need to build a country here. Armenia is not a social club, you know? And a lot of our institutions are based like there's a social club when you're keeping the doors open in some place in Burbank or Fresno or, you know, Beirut. But we need to be focused on building a state. And building a state is not cheap. And I've used this example before, you know, this year we saw what Armenia fundraised. What did Armenia fundraise last year? $10, $15 million? I will bet you that on every given weekend, there's 1,000 to 1,500 Armenians that spend $1,000 each in Las Vegas. So that's $15 million. You're not going to build a country with $50 million. It doesn't work like that. This war itself costs us $30, $40 million a day in a country whose budget is $3.5 billion. You do the math for 44 days. That's a third of your budget. So people don't understand the scale of these things. And the focus needs to be on building a state and most importantly, supporting excellence within that state, because we cannot afford mediocrity. And all of our institutions, as you know, as an academic in Armenia, there's not a single academic university that's in the top 500 in the world, perhaps not even a top 1,000. You know, we have the finest Armenian specialists in hospitals around the world. Do we have one hospital that people built here that people will fly here from all over the region to go to the hospital to? No. So our approach, and again, this is not to take away from individuals who do tremendous work or from institutions who do tremendous work. That's not the issue. The issue is what are you focused on? Or if you're good, I mean, there's obviously a lot of people with goodwill that do stuff every day and think about things. But systematically, we failed as a diaspora. And one of the reasons I say that is because, you know, there's this tendency to blame, oh, it's Hayastan, this and that. No. We have to look at this thing holistically. And we all need to take responsibility for it. We need to look in the mirror and say, okay, we failed. How can we improve this? And this is not just in Hayastan, even though most of it needs to happen in Hayastan. It also needs to happen in the diaspora.
So you need to have leaders in institutions that realize what's happening in Armenia and not perhaps just consider, okay, we're going to Armenia and, you know, being seen with the president or with the prime minister or...
During the worst of the period of leadership in Armenia, for many good reasons, you know, diaspora institutions essentially put their stamp of approval on regimes that should not have had the, you know, stamp of approval. Now, they had practical reasons to do it. They still want to do good things. I understand that. But what was missing was the moral voice. You don't need to compromise all of your moral standing. You can, you know, have some courage. What are they going to do to you? I mean, this isn't, you know, Armenia was never that repressive of a state anyway, to be honest, compared to other places. You know, the worst they're going to do is not to invite you to things. We never had that moral voice. And we allowed this dysfunction to continue. You know, people always ask me, you know, it's like, there's this big mystery. Who lost Shushi? Who gave it away? And I always have an easy answer. I gave it away. Because me, 30 years sitting in Los Angeles, I did nothing to build the place. So until I take responsibility, for losing Shushi, I have no right to blame anybody else. Once I do that, then I can try to find out what happened. So we need to look at these things this way and not to blame other people, because the collective is failure and you need to own it before you can change it.
Well, let's circle back here. We just have a few minutes left. Let's circle back to kind of where we began. We began with the ceasefire agreement of November 10th, and we moved forward there to discussing various aspects. But I'd like to now just talk about what you see as the future for Artsakh, what's left of Artsakh in terms of the political future. Seems to me you said that Russia is going to be there for a very long time. And I don't know that the status of Artsakh will make any difference. So to talk about, you know, independence or what status there is, just I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
I think as a practical matter, most likely what we're seeing is the development of there's going to be two Armenias in the Caucasus. There's going to be Armenia itself and an Armenian speaking Russian province. That's the most likely scenario, because, again, I think the Russians have every intention of staying there, and I think they will stay there, and they will provide security. And over time, if this thing solidifies into some kind of a frozen, unhappy peace, that frozen, unhappy peace will essentially make that region into a far more Russified place, which, again, to a lot of people who live there, it's fine. You know, and for example, on the recognition issue, if Aliyev doesn't give, what Putin has done in other places is to give everybody Russian passports. You give every Artsakhi a Russian passport, it's the same thing as recognizing the place, because no one's going to shoot at 100,000 or 150,000 Russian citizens, ever.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know?
So I think practically that's what we're looking at. Now, I think having said that, it does not take away from the fact that over the next 6 months, year, 2 years, we have to be very, very active in trying to get independence or recognition of some kind that clearly separates the status of Artsakh from Azerbaijan. Clearly. Because first of all, you don't know what the future holds. And we need to use the way they prosecuted this war, which was criminal. They committed war crimes, and they might be even committing war crimes today. We need to use that to prosecute them and to use that as our tool of getting this recognition that we want on some level that is above what it is right now. We should demand independence based on you know, there's actually precedence for it with Kosovo in 2008. You know, there's actually UN, you know, there's actually the UN regulations about it, where if a country targets a specific ethnic minority for genocidal intent, essentially the international community can go in there and separate that part of it from that country, which is what happened in Kosovo. So there's precedence for this. So what the reality is with the Russians should not take us away from what we need to do. Because that also keeps the Russians in check.
Well, war crimes is important that you're referring, and you can clarify, but to bombing civilians with cluster bombs, mm-hmm. using phosphorus-based weapons, other targeting churches and cultural monuments.
So, the biggest one is the use of international terrorism, which is confirmed by the U.S. State Department. By the way, if you use the standard definition of state sponsors of terrorism, given what they did and the fact that the U.S. State Department itself has confirmed this, along with the French Foreign Ministry, along with the Russian Foreign Ministry and Russian intelligence, that qualifies both Azerbaijan and Turkey as state sponsors of terrorism under the U.S. interpretation of what that law means, of that interpretation. So we need to, whether it's executing civilians, whether it's the savagery within our soldiers, whether it's executing wounded soldiers with white phosphorus, whether it's cluster bombs, targeting cultural monuments, they have lost all moral or legal legitimacy to ever have a say over those people, period. And that's the point that we need to drive home, that we need to do that regardless of what's going on there or how long the Russians are going to stay, because it's irrelevant. If you grant that area some level of status and the Russians are still there, you know, whenever they leave, you know, history has its tops and turns, you know. You know, the Russian state collapsed twice in one century, in the last century. So, or the Soviet, the Russian and the Soviet state. So it's important for us to fight for that.
Well, you know,
regardless of what's going on the ground.
You're an American, I'm an American. For Armenians in America in particular, this whole absence of America, absence of any voice of the United States, and just what you were saying, even at a higher level than the State Department, was a big void and was very disappointing. Do you see any changes possible happening?
I don't want to be partisan about it, but the Trump administration was unique in its approach. Or no approach. I think to the extent that the Biden administration is a restoration of the American political establishment in many ways, they will be more engaged here, like, you know, on the same level of the Obamas and the Bushes on that scale. So you're sort of seeing the reintroduction of the United States as some kind of a political player in the region. What that means in practical terms, let's just say it's for the good. How much for the good, we don't know. But just a complete lack, and I think there were some really strange things that were going on between Erdogan and Trump, this love affair that they had, which was God knows based on what, was obviously not helpful. Because despite all of their issues, Trump was one person that could have ended this war very quickly. If Trump would have called Erdogan and said, I'm going to put a sanctions on the lira or something like that, this war would have ended in 2 days. It's reality, because the Turkish economy is, you know, standing on one leg.
It's a very fascinating area. It's very much, of course, this whole conflict has been something that's been in the hearts of Armenians. And I've been really enjoyed having this conversation with you. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My guest today has been Eric Agopian. We've been discussing Artsakh, Armenia, the situation following the war and the ceasefire agreement. And it's really been very much enjoying his insight and be following his work in Armenia through CivilNet and other means. For All Things Armenian, this is Professor Barlo Demirgadichian. Thanking you for joining us today. And we'll see you next week for another episode of All Things Armenian.
Broadcasting from the Mono Wind Casino Studios. This is Multicultural AM 1600 KGST Fresno.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.